You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCRLP, 92.9 FM, Los Gatos and beyond.
Hi, I'm Jeff Zentner, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show. Yeah.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Jeff Zentner. He's the author of Colton Gentry's Third Act, a novel. Jeff, how are you?
I'm doing well, Tony. How are you?
Thank you for asking. I've kind of had a rough week. And the last couple days, I resolved to get rid of this darkness through exercise and yoga. And I was just like, and it's just got to hurt. And even if I'm tired and I'm waking up early and I'm getting out there, I don't care if it hurts. And like today, I finally like feel enough of a shift where my brain's not giving me, you know, the brain just gives you that self-talk that just goes nuts. And it was swirling and swirling. So I just got off the treadmill. Right before we got on here, I did the ice cold shower. And
you got a glow. You're glowing.
Oh, well, thank you.
I see that LA sunshine pouring in the window to your side.
Yeah. This is our first day of sunshine in a while. We've been rain. We've been cold. It's been fantastic. I'm from San Francisco. Wow. So I'm like dancing in the streets as it rains while everyone else is weeping. And I'm like, yes. So, and you're out in Nashville.
That's right. I'm in Nashville. We are in the season that I have just, I just finally settled on a name for it. I call it Irish Spring because it looks like Ireland this time of year in Tennessee. Everything is so vibrantly green. It tickles your eyes to look at the world.
You have just sold me. I haven't visited Nashville and I got a couple friends there and it's on my list to get to Nashville. And you just sold me on like, I should probably move there.
It's great. Oh, you should. It's great. It's great.
I've heard nothing but good things. It's especially music wise. And it's a music town.
Oh man, can't be beat, but it's all different. It's all the arts really. It's music. It's all the ecosystem that surrounds music. So it's videographers, it's graphic designers, it's, directors. But then there's just a lot of other stuff going on. Nashville is a huge food city. Like all these big time chefs are moving to Nashville and setting up shop. And this is one I recently discovered and kind of blew my mind. So America's fashion capital is obviously New York City, right?
Okay.
Long shot.
Yeah.
second place, LA, obviously. Third place is apparently like a dead heat between Columbus, Ohio, of all places, which Columbus is a pretty cool city, pretty underrated. But Columbus, Ohio and Nashville as third place for American fashion. So I thought that was really interesting. So there's just a lot going on here.
That is interesting. What I guess would that be where fashion is like, is that designers and stuff? Is that how they're rating it?
I guess so. Yeah. Designers, fashion brands, fashion houses. Yeah.
Huh. I could see Nashville more. And this is from somebody who doesn't know anything about these states. So, but it just, I want to go to all these states. Like I am determined to hit like people. I'm like, I'm going to Pittsburgh. I'm doing this trip where it's just like Pittsburgh, Gary, Indiana. I want to just do the stuff that it's just like, just get there, see the people. Come on. You're in this country. Just like sit there for a week. I know you can sit there for a week, sit in a diner, drink coffee. And then maybe by day four, the older dudes are like, okay, you can come play chess at our table. And I'm like, all right. And then I know I'm in.
Exactly.
I just did not understand how close many things are, like Kentucky to what's right across the river from Kentucky? Is it Pennsylvania?
There's a region of Pennsylvania called Pennsyltucky. I don't know if they share a border though.
Okay.
So there's West Virginia that borders Kentucky. I think Ohio does because part of Cincinnati is in Kentucky. So Ohio definitely does.
Okay.
What else? Obviously, Tennessee on the south. Maybe does Indiana? Maybe? I don't know.
It's close there. So it's so, I mean, what you people like, we don't realize, I don't know if you, how much you've been on the West Coast, but we're like really separated. Yeah, there's like Los Angeles and San Francisco, but these cities are like different countries and different continents because it's just hard to get to, where things seem closer on your side of the pond or your side of the land.
Yeah, our side of the Mississippi.
Yeah, yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, in the South, you could start out from Nashville, and within 4 hours, you could be in Atlanta, you could be in Louisville, you could be in Birmingham, you could be in Huntsville, you could be in Memphis, you could be in Asheville, North Carolina, which is another great city, Chattanooga. I mean, there's just all these really phenomenal cities in the Southeast that you can get to really quickly. It's why the South is a great place for bands to tour, because you know, there's these quick little 3 hour drives between big markets.
Right. Yeah. Cause that West Coast, like, I don't know. Did you ever tour the West Coast?
Yeah. And it was brutal.
That's why you were lit when I told you about the distance from the cities. You're like, dude, I know. I was in a van.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. We drove from Portland, Oregon to San Francisco. And I was like, come on, how long a drive could it be? How far could it be? Uh-huh. It was like 18 hours through the most winding, mountainous terrain. I've never taken a longer drive in my life. It was absolutely insane.
Compared to driving from Portland to San Francisco, it's almost like flying from Los Angeles to Australia.
Oh my gosh. It was intense. It was really intense.
Do you remember the clubs you played in San Francisco? You didn't know you needed research
before. No, this would have been, this would have been over a decade ago, like 15, it would have been 15 years ago easily. Oh. And I just do not have that information in my head any longer.
Sometimes it's better to forget because there's a lot of things that happened 15 years ago. I'm like, sometimes I remember and I wish I didn't remember.
Right.
It's like, tying all of this in, see, I'll pretend like this was all planned. And as I've gone over the show notes, tying all this into your book, but speaking of third acts, it's like, I really like the idea because I think about this a lot because I also teach writing as well. And I teach screenwriting a lot too. Sure. So I'm like, I am just constantly like drilling my poor students with the three act structure. And at first I was really, I didn't want to teach screenwriting. I'm like, no, I'm teaching novel and that's it. That's not, no way. Cause I'm in LA. I don't want to teach screenwriting. You know, it's just, I was being my own worst. I was just being a fool. And then they're like, no, you're going to lose your work. Then you don't teach here anymore. If you don't teach screenwriting, I'm like, I'll teach screenwriting. So, but the thing I've learned about the hero's journey is it's kind of seeped into my thinking of like, oh wait, I'm in act one of this current problem and I'm in act three of that current problem in my life. And I really like that idea that we have different acts in our lives. Like thinking of it that way just changes the perspective.
I mean, I think it's not insane to think that three-act structure arises out of human experience. Like human experience kind of tends to follow certain rhythms. There's certain peaks and valleys. I mean, if there's any benefit to getting older, besides the, you know, the aching backs and the aching knees.
And the colonoscopies.
And the colonoscopy, that's right. It's that those things become clearer to you. You start to see these patterns unfold. Life starts to seem a little less chaotic. You're like, okay, going through a hard time right now, but as I know, things are going to get better and things will be good for a while. And then it'll get bad again and then it'll get better again. And so, it makes it all go down a little smoother, I think.
It does. I mean, sometimes I don't feel it does. And I get back in the the hole I was in last week, which sounds like a porno film. But But, you know, you just it's like sometimes you forget, oh, wait, I've gone through worse things before. And
sure,
it's and especially like as it's just if we have the pattern that's just like, oh, wait, we fought that dragon already. We slayed that dragon in Act 3 when I was 26. Okay, now I could do it again.
That's right.
I think. And, you know, and then I wake up and realize I'm wrong about everything. No, that's usually at 3 a.m. when I can't sleep. I'm wrong about everything.
It's a good time to spiral is 3 a.m. I know that from experience.
Why do you think that is, that that we get that in the middle of the night when things are quiet, our brain just goes to dark places?
Okay. So, well, or just goes places in general. Are you familiar with the concept of diphasic sleep?
No.
Okay. So apparently, before industrialization, this is Science Hour with Jeff. Before industrialization, and this is all true. I'm going to mangle some details, but it's basically true and supported by science.
Yeah.
Before industrialization and the availability of artificial light, right? Humans apparently used to sleep in two phases, right? So people would go to bed at sundown, and they would sleep from like sundown until like midnight. Then they would wake up. There would be like a 2 or 3 hour period of wakefulness where people would like go visit with neighbors. They would say prayers. They would do things around the house. So they're up in the middle of the night doing this stuff. And this is documented. They have like prayer books where there's like a prayer for first sleep is what they call it. And then a prayer for second sleep. And then you'd go to sleep again and you'd sleep till, you know, whenever. And they find that when you take modern humans and rob them of sources of artificial light, they naturally fall into this diphasic sleeping pattern, or biphasic, bi or di, anyway, one of the two phases is the point. So I just remember that sometimes when I wake up like wide awake at 2 a.m. that like it's not totally unnatural to do that. And I just read something or, you know, try to find something to occupy my mind for a little while. And then I fall back asleep. But yeah, weird, huh?
It's weird. And it would be so cool to hang out with people at that time. Wouldn't it be? Yeah. It's like, oh, wait, and I think there might even be we might be on a different wave level because we just got out of dreams, or we're closer to our subconscious, where we're interacting with people maybe on more of a, like, not, I don't know if it's an authentic level, but just the level of like a little more intensity, and then you're out again. And
I'll tell you what I think it would be good for. I would love to write during that time. Like, you know, I think that would be some good writing time, some nice, quiet, middle of the night, peaceful writing hours. That would be awesome.
I'm thinking of a writing retreat where there's just no light and
it's just like,
yeah, exactly. It's just like, hey, you guys do whatever you want during the day. And then at sundown, we're all asleep and we'll see you all at midnight.
Yeah, exactly.
That'd be fun. When did you start writing?
So I started writing in 2012, so I'm relatively new to writing. What happened was I was a musician for a lot of years, and I kind of gradually started to realize that I was not going to make it big in music. Like, that was not going to be my livelihood. I hadn't had my big break. I didn't make very popular or commercial type music. And so I kind of packed in the dreams of being a musician, and I started volunteering at a music camp for teenagers called Tennessee Teen Rock Camp. And there's a sister camp called Southern Girls Rock Camp that I volunteered at. And the idea just being to pass on my musical knowledge to kids who might be able to do more with their dreams than I was able to do. So I start volunteering at this camp, and I do it for several years and really fall in love with the way that young adults love the art that they love. Like, there's a real magic to it, and there's a real beauty with the way that young people form the attachments with the art that they love, and they let it move them, and they let it become part of their identity. It weaves itself into the fabric of their being in this really beautiful way. And I wanted to make art for teenagers. And so I started thinking of ways I could do that. Music was out, like, period. Like, by the time I'm having this realization, I'm old enough to be Billie Eilish's father, right? So I'm not going to be making music for young adults. That's not
going to happen. We're all old enough to be Billie Eilish's father.
I know, right? So what am I going to do if I want to make art for young adults? And I start looking around for possibilities, and I notice that there's this big category of books called YA books, young adult books. And I say, hey, wait a minute. It kind of seems like you don't need to be young to get your break in publishing. I know I have dear friends who have had their debuts in their 50s, in their 60s. Norman McLean, who wrote A River Runs Through It, Brad Pitt, Robert Redford movie. I believe he debuted with that short story collection at age 72. So there's just not the same expiration date as music. So I said,
isn't it great? Because there's something about it. And that's the thing that sucks about the idea of, it drives me nuts about music, because music is so, what's the face? Who's the sexy body we're looking at, plus the music, instead of just listening to the music. And, there's a beauty to, because I mean, if someone's, you know, starting out in their 50s, 60s in music, they have the life experience. They're probably going to delve into some really deep stuff that I would connect to.
Many
people would connect to.
Well, and the thing is, too, it's not like Olympic gymnastics, where there simply are no 40 and 50 year olds competing, right? It's not like that. There are old people in music. Keith Richards is what, 98? There are old people in music. It's just that they all got their big break in their 20s. So if we let people in the door in their 20s and let them make music for the rest of their lives, why not let people in the door at age 60 and let them make music for the rest of their lives? But they don't.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
I don't make the rules. It sucks, but that's the way it is. So,
and we should make the rules. We got to figure out a way to make the rules.
Nobody is trusting me with that responsibility, but if you figure out a way.
Revolution now. Ears. Yes. Okay, go ahead.
Exactly. So I was like, hey, that, you know, I love books. I've always loved books. I started out as a reader. And in fact, the reason I didn't start as an author younger was I just thought that wasn't the sort of thing that people like me did. I grew up in a small town. I didn't know any authors, never met an author, and I just idealized them and thought they lived in ivory towers, and that it was not something that somebody like me could do. But
and you find
people
out
like me can.
You find out those ivory towers are usually studio apartments in basements in Brooklyn.
Exactly. So I took up music instead, and so by the time I'm having this realization that I could write books for teenagers. I'm still young enough to write books. And so that's what I decide to do. So I switch my focus entirely from music to writing. So if you want to map this journey onto, Colton Gentry's third act in terms of acts, first act is music. Second act, writing books for young adults. So I write and publish 4 books for young adults. I actually have a 5th one coming out in July that I co-wrote with a YA author friend. So Colton is not my only book release this year. But so I write and publish 4, soon to be 5 young adult novels. But then I get an idea for a novel that I simply cannot write as a young adult novel. You cannot write a middle-aged country musician struggling with alcoholism and the public death of his marriage and the death of his career. You cannot write that character as a 17-year-old. It just doesn't work. So I moved into my third act, which is writing for grownups now. So Colton Gentry's third act is also Jeff Zentner's third act.
I like that a lot. When you say, hey, wait a second, let's do this young adult. What are some of the young adult, like, was there young adult books that you were just like, wait, the I'm watching these kids dive into this certain author. I need to read that author. And is that how you expose yourself to young adult?
To some extent, yeah. At the time that I was having this realization, John Green was having a real moment. He's still one of my favorite young adult authors, and so
and what did
I
he write?
Read him.
Just because I need to, you know, I'm starting to read more young adult, and and I need so it's Jeff Green, is that a name?
John Green.
John Green. Okay.
Yeah.
What did he write?
And the fact that you haven't heard of him makes me feel really good, and as a reminder that there is no level of fame you can get to as a young adult author where you are universally famous. So thank you for not knowing who he is. He wrote.
Yo, you have no idea what I don't know.
So my favorite of his is called Looking for Alaska.
Okay.
And it's a gorgeous, soulful YA book set at a boarding school. I love boarding school books. My last YA book, In the Wild Light, is a boarding school book, kind of inspired by that. But his big book, and the one that I guarantee you've seen around, is The Fault in Our Stars. This is the cover. I'm sure you've seen that.
Okay. Yeah, it looks
somewhere.
Familiar. Yeah.
It should look familiar because this sold like 24 million copies. This was a certified blockbuster hit.
Yeah.
But I really loved his books. I loved the voice of his books. I loved I loved kind of his philosophical bent, and he kind of looked at the world in a way similar to the way I did. And I thought, you know, maybe there's a place for a voice like mine in young adult. So I did it.
Wow. That's, I love that. That's, and then at that point, when you're working on your first young adult book, you're reading the other authors and going, okay, this is going, I got it. Like, did you realize you had something, or was there a couple of like, stops and like, wait, maybe I don't have it. Maybe,
I think it came very naturally, and I think the reason is because it did come from a place of such love for young adults and such desire to connect with them, and really such respect for them. I really it was a challenge to write for them because I know how smart young adults are. I know how demanding they are. I did not come to the page lightly because I understood how challenging it would be to write for them. And so it was exciting. And the way the process that I settled on is the process I still use, which is I allowed the characters to dictate the story to me. So I said, if I'm going to write a young adult book, it better involve people whose lives I want to inhabit, whose experience I want to inhabit. So I thought of some characters, settled on some characters, and I just let them live in my head until they took shape as real people. They became, I joke that I let artificial intelligence write my books, which is true, but they're artificial intelligences that I've cooked up in my own mind. So these characters take on a life, they take on a personality, they take on a story, and then these characters begin to tell me their story, and I start to write that story down. And so it's cheating in a way, I almost feel like. It's almost as if I were to go to you and say, tell me who you are, tell me all about yourself, who you love, who loves you, what you desire, what you fear, what you've overcome, what you need to overcome, all those things that make you and all people's stories in human form. And I just write down what you tell me, and there's my story. So it feels like cheating in a way, because they carry so much of the water for the writing of the story.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's Henry Miller called it channeling, but I've heard that word before used, and I kind of feel the same way when I'm doing a rewrite right now, because you've written young adult and then you've written this first literary fiction, I've been working on a book for 2.5 years, and the protagonist is 40, and last month I realized he's 18. Because I was writing the prequel to the book for the next one. And then I was, as I was doing it, it was younger him. And then I was like, oh, you gotta be kidding me. It was just screaming. It's like, dude, you gotta rewrite that novel again, because it's, It was like right in my face the whole time. Of course this guy's 18. He's got problems with his parents. It's like all this stuff going on, but I put it in a 40-year-old, you know. Why? Because I was, you know, I don't know why. Maybe I needed to sit there with the 40-year-old protagonist and put him through all this stuff, and then I got to pull a lot back. So
that's so magical, though. I think as frustrating as that experience is, I also think it's magical.
Yeah,
when,
I do too.
You can't impose your will on a character. When that character says, "Nope, I'm throwing off the chains of your will, and I am going to lead my own life." It's so magical. I think it makes writing so rewarding, because then you're along for the ride and you're like, oh, I'm getting to learn this character's story as they're telling it to me. So that is really beautiful. That's the part I call the cutting wrapping paper part of writing. You know how sometimes you cut wrapping paper and you make a couple cuts and then the scissors just start to glide?
Yeah.
How good that feels.
Yeah.
That's a great feeling. And that's what I call the cutting wrapping paper phase of
writing. I like that. Yeah. It's the character. That's when, I mean, our character, I work on stuff, I realize I'm more intimate with these characters than a lot of my friends, because I'm spending 4 hours a day with them. And then if I have a problem with my character, I'm thinking about it at night and going, well, I'll sleep on it, because I'll figure out how to deal with my character tomorrow. And it's just all of a sudden, I mean, these characters become kind of more real than anything. And it's just funny to like to talk about them with, you know, when you're getting into different phases of it, whether it's published book or a film, and you're like just talking about these characters like they're real. But as far as I'm concerned, oh, they're real. And it's, there's no like, they're not, there's no like, oh yeah, no, these came out of thin air. Even though I love how you use the word magic, I feel the word magic has a lot to do with the creative process, because we're making something out of nothing. How do I get your book in my hands from an idea you had in your head? It was just an idea. And I think that is so much fun that it becomes this.
It really is magical.
Yeah. I feel like we both need to take a breath on that and just go, oh. And then, And then there's the dog days too. I mean, there's the days where it's just like, why? I tell my students, I'm like, you know what? It's like a marriage, and you want to love your wife, and sometimes you just can't stand her snoring, or you know, and all of a sudden there's a beautiful young woman walking by, and you look at her and go, you know what? I want to be with her, but that's just an idea that's trying to take up your brain. Well, you need to stay with the wife. So what you do, what we get to do as writers is we just write that idea down and put it away. So we can have like 100 mistresses on the side ready to go when we're done with the marriage of finishing our books to completion.
For me, that beautiful woman is Netflix. But yes, your point is well taken.
Oh, but because my problem is when I'm working on something, I have other sexier ideas, and it's just like they got to go somewhere. They just go in a notebook because they're not going to work with this. And if you jump on every single new idea, you'll have 20 pages of novels. Oh, I have 1,000 novels that are 20 pages long and haven't gotten even into the.
I wish I could relate to that. I get one idea at a time. I get idea pregnancies. I get one idea at a time, and I have to see it through to term before I can work on anything else. I'm really jealous of people who can get other ideas while they're working on something, but I get one idea. So if I write a book and it's not a success, I can't really lament it, because I wrote the story that I had available to me at the time. And my choice was to write the story or not write the story, but there was no choice to write a different story. So it's kind of nice in that way. But yeah, I wish I had more ideas, but I don't.
For me, it's usually in the early days, because when I'm throwing, you know, when I'm just kind of throwing the paint on the canvas. And so it's just like, wait, what about, oh, you know what? This could be more fun. And then after a while, after about 3 months of work where you're doing like 4 hours a day and you're like, wait a second, is this the thing? I mean, this is how I do it. Cause I do it wrong. I feel people are just, they're like, how do you write? And I go, well, I handwrite all my first drafts and then I type them all in, and people are like, oh, is that how you're supposed to do it? I'm like, no, it's a terrible way to do it. but it's just the way I do it. And it's, you know, it's not fast, it's slower, but yeah, I forgot where I was going with it, but yeah, I guess we just that's the beauty of what I love about the writing process is that we all have our unique process. And I also think we have each project has its unique process. Do you find that? Absolutely. Like when you're working on a book, the book goes, hey, wait a second, I need 2.5 hours a day. I need 3 hard boiled eggs at noon. And you're just going, oh, okay, you got it.
Yeah. Every book writes differently. My third book, I just screamed through the first half of the book. And then I hit a brick wall like I have never hit before. And I said, well, I know how this book's going to end. And there's no writing police, there's no linear time police that forces you to write a book in chronological order. You won't go to jail. So I decided to write the final scene because I knew what the final scene was. And then I said, well, I know how we got to get to the final scene. So I wrote the second to last scene and then the third to last and fourth. And you see where I'm going here. I mean, I just backed right up into the first half of the book and it just fit seamlessly. And there was just no rule that you can't do it that way. I mean, that's really the beauty of writing, is any process that ends with a finished book is a valid process. The only process I say you need to look elsewhere is if your process is not resulting in finished manuscripts, because you absolutely will not publish a book if you can't finish a manuscript. That is the one prerequisite. The one absolute prerequisite to publishing is you've got to finish a manuscript. So, but other than that, anything that results in a completed manuscript, whether it takes you 3 months or, you know, 30 years, valid process, I say.
Yeah. I just remembered, because my memory is short term here. You were talking about boarding school books, and one of the most classic YA, it's classified as YA. I'm like, and I never like kind of really thought about that, but Catcher in the Rye.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's one of the quintessential ones.
Yeah. And that's one I read it again about
a separate piece too.
Oh, I read that at one of the few books. I didn't start reading much until I was in my 20s, but one of the few books I read that I loved in high school was A Separate Piece. I need to read that again.
Yeah.
There was like, and this always, this sticks with me. This is so long ago, but I think it was in A Separate Piece. One of the characters, instead of using a belt, he used his tie, like a suit and tie. And he knotted it. Well, he didn't knot it. So what? Because I grew up a Jehovah's Witness, so I had to wear ties all the time. So what I did was, to try to be cool, I started doing I tied a knot in a tie, and so I used my suit ties as my belt, and I actually tied a real like suit tie knot, and the tie went into my pocket, and I did that for like 5 years, and I think it was because of the book A Separate Piece.
It's a great idea.
Yeah, I just, it's, you know, the things that come to you when you're drinking sparkling water called Liquid Death. I forgot about that one. That's a good one. Yeah, because I read Catcher in the Rye, I think, when I was in my 20s. And then I read it again a few years ago, and I was just like, is this thing still going to hit? And I read it, and I'm like, oh, yeah, it hits. It's good.
It's a classic for a reason.
Yeah. What's you know what? I read, I don't know if I read it in your biography. It's in your biography somewhere. And you're like, wait a second, now I got to come up with that. I've had that before. People have interviewed me, and it's fine. They go, you know, we have a quote from you. And I'm just going, and they're like, so what does that mean? I'm like, I said that. But and I'm like, I must have been drunk. Those were my dark, drunk Jameson days. Well, see, I totally forgot what I was going to say. Your parents dropping you off at the library.
Yeah. Yeah, that was where I forged my relationship with books. So I learned how to read really early. I learned how to read when I was like 3. So I was oldest
Wow.
child. My parents were determined to get it right with me. So my mom read to me constantly, to where by about age 3, I was reading on my own. And I would get very interested in a topic, and I would just need to read more and more about it. And so my mom would take me to the library. She'd drop me off, and I would just read through every book on the shelf on a given topic, whether whales or Vikings or construction equipment or all my like kiddie obsessions. I swear I was like, on the spectrum as a kid. Because I would just get obsessed with something and could not get enough of it. And as I got older and able to be at the library by myself, now this was, this was the 80s. So things were a little different. By the time I
You
was
could
about
drop
10
a
or
9-year-old
11,
off. I mean, I
could
remember
drop
taking the,
exactly.
I took the bus to school when I was like 9 years old, and then parents like get arrested for putting their kids on the subway at 9 years old now. And I'm like, wait, what kind of soft, safe place are we in now? We came out of it
Different
all
time,
right.
man. Different
Yeah.
time. So my mom would drop me off at the library with a quarter for the payphone, and I would just read to my heart's content. I would read for hours and hours and hours. I'd just stay there, and that's where I really forged my relationship with books. But also, in this weird counterintuitive way, it dissuaded me from writing books because I put books on such a pedestal, and I assumed that such magical objects could only come from magical people. It never occurred to me that books could come from pretty normal people who are just simply willing to put in a lot of time and listen to criticism that will make them better writers and craft something. Never occurred to me.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's crazy about the listening to criticism. That's so huge. I was when you know even when I was when I was a young drinks with Tony guy. I started this show like 20 years ago, and one of my first guests was Chuck Palahniuk, and
Oh, wow.
yeah, it's because there was no internet web streams. There wasn't even a word for podcasting yet, and they're like, oh wow, you're doing this weird thing on the internet. And I'm like, oh yeah, sure. They're like, do you want to interview Chuck? And I'm like, what? So I said yes. But what I learned from that interview, because I always thought of him as this guy who's just like, I'm gonna walk in there with my book and I'm God, and I'm gonna drop that manuscript on the table, and I'm gonna walk away, and they're gonna go, hey, we need some changes. And he's gonna go, no changes. It's already godlike. And as I'm interviewing him, I'm like, so what's it like dealing with editors? Like, do you got to tell them where to stick it? And he goes, oh no, you listen to what they say, because they make the book better. And it was that, like, it didn't shatter my experience. What it did is it opened me up and went, oh my God, that makes so much sense. Because I think I was coming from this idea of punk rock or whatever, where it's just like, we're just three chords and we're gonna go hard, and it's just
Yeah,
like, that's
you
the
don't
album.
compromise. You don't take feedback. I'll tell you that here's the three things that I think you need to become an author, and only these three things, really. I believe this, and I speak at a lot of high schools, so I tell the kids this. First thing is you got to have a story to tell, which that's the easy part. We all have a story to tell by having moved through the world, by having gathered, a treasure of sorrows and joys and loves and experiences and fascinations. So we become stories, right? We have stories to tell. Okay. So that's the first one. Second one is you got to be able to finish what you start, which is where a lot of really brilliant, talented people fall off the path, is because they just can't finish a damn book. But like I tell the kids, nobody wants to read a book that ends mid-sentence three-fourths of the way through. That's not a good book. So if you can't finish what you start, you're never going to become an author. And then the third one is, like we were just talking about, you have to be able to take the right amount of criticism that will make you a stronger writer, but not break you. So on one end of the spectrum, we've got our punk rock You don't, nobody tells me what to do. I have an artistic vision. You know, I'm going to see that vision through. Well, that's fine and dandy, but the bad news is there's never been a great author who wasn't edited ever. So you're never going to be published. Sorry. And on the other end of the spectrum are people who shatter into a million pieces at the first hint of red ink on a manuscript. They're like, oh, I can't do this. I suck. I'm terrible. And you can't publish books when you're lying on the floor in a million pieces. So you got to find a middle path to where you're letting in the criticism that will make you better, but not letting it break you and keep you from finishing what you start, which is rule number two.
I like that a lot. And the idea of getting that criticism of the book redlined, and also with let us know what you think of these changes and blah, blah, blah. That's like a relief, because the other part is like, yeah, we don't want this.
Yeah.
We figured out exactly who you are and we're done. And it's just like, no. I'll change it. Help. When you, so as you're developing a following from young adults, when you go visit some of these young adults, are you kind of a rock star then when you talk to these people?
Yeah, I mean, a minor, very, very minor rock star. High school kids aren't used to having even the most miniature of celebrities visit their high school. So I get treated well.
Do they have catering?
Times,
no, I'm kidding. Where's craft service?
I've had to ask for many a recipe after a lunch or a breakfast that librarians put on. Let me tell you something. From my music days, it is night and day to touring as an author. Like when I go to these high schools, everything runs like clockwork because it's librarians running things. It's not music people. You know, we would drive, speaking of West Coast, we would drive from Billings, Montana to Spokane, Washington, not an insignificant distance. We would arrive at some terrible dive bar and they'd say, all right, so you guys just going to set up your PA over there or what? And we're like, our PA? We don't travel with a PA. The venue has the PA. That's how live music works. We don't travel with a PA. What were you planning on doing? And so there's just none of that in books. So the librarians will whip the kids into a frenzy. They will have the whole school reading the book. So yeah, you do get treated like a rock star when you go on these school visits, and it's amazing. But it's not because I'm a great celebrity or a rock star. It's because these librarians are rock stars.
And yes.
They lay the groundwork for it, and they make it happen.
Yeah. No, libraries are everything. It's one of the institutions in this country that I will like stand behind. I'll probably even defend it to the death. It's because libraries, I mean, I didn't really find them out until I was in my 20s, but they saved my life. And they saved my life at a hard time, and it opened me up to books. And I would not be here right now talking to you if there wasn't a library that was two blocks away from me when I was in a very dark space. And then all of a sudden I started letting these authors have a conversation with me that talked about feelings and that no one ever was open about around me. And I'm just like, wait, what? And that was it. I was off.
So great.
Yeah. So that's so cool. Yeah. It's beautiful too, to get the kids. It gives me hope for the next generation. Cause what is it? Generation TikTok or something, you know, where all these companies are like grabbing for their attention. Cause they want to just sell you crap. It's just like, how do we get these kids at, you know, and, you know, look at I'm wearing my San Francisco Giants jersey right now, right? Because they got me when I was young, when I lived in San Francisco, and all of a sudden now this talked about, this is, you know, I'm a grown adult and I still text my friends in San Francisco and we're just like, you know, bashing the Dodgers and just like, did you see that call? You know, it's just, and it's what brings us together. And it was because we were marketed to at a young age. And this is pre-internet. And then now these poor kids are getting inundated, though, with just like, grab your attention over here, over here. But to get them reading books, that's going to create a good generation. Just right there.
For sure.
Just reading, for sure. Just getting through a book a week.
Yeah.
It makes people empathetic. It works on brain cells.
It absolutely does.
Yeah. I mean, even when I don't feel like reading, I try to read about 50 pages a day just to keep, what my friend Janet Fitch said. She's just like, she says, reading is breathing in, writing is breathing out. And it just makes much sense. Yeah. It's just like, that's the, cause we have to keep the conversation going. So if I'm writing, I also need to be reading constantly and in someone else's head. And then even crazier, you know, when you're going to high schools and you're telling the kids how to write, and I'm doing different writing classes. And when I do these classes, it feeds me too, because I better practice what I preach the next day. If I'm preaching to these guys that they need to have their butts in their chairs and that blank page is going to be there and they're going to feel nauseous, but you just go ahead and you do it anyway because everyone feels nauseous, so we're all fine. And then after I do my big preaching from the pulpit, it's like the next day I better be doing exactly as I say.
Yep, I hear you.
Yeah. When you were touring, I feel like you've seen a lot more of the United States than I have. What's like a favorite city where if you could just go, you know what? I'm not gonna live in Nashville. I'm gonna live blank. I have the opening to any city I want. What city would it be for you?
Ooh, wow.
I know. I just thought of that too, and it just blew my mind.
You know, I am a big fan of Chattanooga, Tennessee. Chattanooga, Tennessee is a great city. It's this beautiful city on the river. It's in the mountains. It's near enough to Atlanta to make it accessible. But, you know, without the traffic of Atlanta, Chattanooga is a really great, beautiful place. Now that I did play in Chattanooga occasionally when I was a musician. My Chattanooga love, though, isn't based on my touring as a musician. It's just based on visits to Chattanooga since then. I did have great cities that I loved to play as a musician. They were always these kind of smaller markets like Bowling Green, Kentucky, all right, or Macon, Georgia, right? They're not quite these like, you know, Nashville-sized cities. They're big enough cities that there's stuff going on. There's colleges there, and there's, you know, there's stuff there. You're not living in a small town, but there's enough of a community to go see live music, but they're also bored enough to go see live music. So I used to love playing in those cities. But yeah, I think if I had to live anywhere but Nashville, it would be 2 hours down the road, Chattanooga, Tennessee. Where would you live if you could live in a different city?
Oh, that is a good question.
You live in San Francisco and you're in LA now.
Those are my only two I have right now. But see, I haven't visited a lot of the United States. It's, you know, I think I'm craving a smaller city right now. Like something,
yeah.
When you say Chattanooga, I'm just like sitting there going, that just sounds sexy as hell to me. Because I think Nashville
would be a good fit for you, man. That would be a good step down from Los Angeles. Yeah. Chattanooga might be a little too much of a drop off for you. I don't know.
Yeah. It's, I got to visit these cities. A friend of mine, she and her husband just moved to Wilmington, North Carolina.
Oh, that's a beautiful city.
Yeah.
Right on the water.
And I need to go visit them. And, cause they lived in LA for like 20 years, but their family's back there. So they found a house and we're just like, we're moving. And, and I really want to like visit there and kind of hang in the, you know, North Carolina area. I have a list of places I need to visit. So I don't feel like my knowledge is great enough yet to go to know where, but I'm in a weird moment in time where I feel very open to be elsewhere, it's like I haven't really felt this way before, and it's kind of open to what's next, where I'm pointed. And it's almost like being a character in a book where I'm like, you know what, I don't even know where it is, And it could be Fresno. Who knows? You know, it might not. It might be close to me. It might be, you know, I might be in Madrid. You know, who knows? But I'm just keeping everything very just open. And, you know, at some point, as I continue to work on my Act 3, it'll narrow down further and further where I'll be like, oh, wait a second, blank. And then I'll be like, you know, hey, Jeff, do you got a room for it? Because you grew up in Nashville, too, right?
No, I didn't. Oh. I've lived in Nashville now most of my life, but yeah. I grew up kind of all over. But it's like a complicated story. And so I just say I'm from Nashville. It's easier. And Nashville is my chosen hometown.
Yeah. I like that. You know, I'm learning Spanish right now, and I got it. I'm in early days, so if you know Spanish, don't hit me hard. But but I love I'm learning the way to say I'm from and I live, and the characteristics of, I think it's the verb where if or not that it's a, if it's like something that can't be changed, you say it in a different way. So if you say I'm from. Yeah. San Francisco, it's different. And then you say, I live in LA, there's a different angle on it. And it just kind of blew my mind open. I'm just like, oh my God, why didn't I start learning this language deeper earlier? Because it's such a interesting way to think about it. These are the unchangeable things in your life. And here's a changeable thing. And we just bring it up every day in conversation.
Yep. Yep.
Do you know Spanish? Is that why you're like, you're just going, oh yeah, dude.
Well, I do. I speak Portuguese. I'm fluent in Portuguese.
Oh, are you? Obrigado. Really, yeah, that's all I really got. That's as far as I go.
Yeah, well, that's good. You got it. You just, that's, you can be polite and say thank you in Portuguese. Yeah. So I do speak Portuguese, and it's really similar to Spanish. And so I speak okay Spanish, but Portuguese is where I really shine. Oh. I was the first, I actually did a book festival in São Paulo, Brazil. And I was the first American author ever to do an untranslated in conversation at this book festival.
Wow. How cool is that?
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
At Sao Paulo, that's just that intrigues me. When I was a kid, I remember Nick Cave, one of my favorite musicians. He lived in Sao Paulo for about 3 or 4 years. And I was just I was just like, oh, wow, I must go there because Nick Cave was there and he knows everything. And then I don't know if you follow him or read his Red Hand Files and the stuff he does now. And it's the same thing.
I recorded with him.
Did you really?
Yeah, I've got a couple album credits with him. We recorded together on a song for a tribute album to Jeffrey Lee Pierce of the Gun Club. So I was on a track with him duetting with Debbie Harry, and I was on the track with him and Iggy Pop and Thurston Moore from Sonic Youth.
Wow. How cool.
Really
is that?
Great guy.
Yeah. Yeah. When was that record? What? Because that's kind of recent. I thought that came out.
That was back in 2009.
Oh, okay.
Something like that.
Everything just blurs after my divorce. I was like, what? Oh, that's cool. When you're is there a point where I'm a huge fanboy of Nick Cave. I've interviewed him a few times, and every time I've like walked out of the room, I'm like, hey. But when I'm in the room, I'm just like, yeah, so is there anyone that you've like, where that you've had that same effect where you're just like, oh, I just got to go and do some good work. And then you walk out of there and you're like, how did I hang out with him and not, you know, puke?
That's a good question. I would have to think about that one. There's not somebody that immediately springs to mind.
Well, you have a YA novel coming out, so we may have to talk again when you got that thing coming out too. So.
I know. Yeah.
We might have a part two on this.
Awesome.
Yeah. Jeff, thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, man, it was a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I was thumbing a ride one Saturday morning out of Nashville, toting my sack. I lent my car to a gal that lived in Chattanooga and she hadn't ever brought it back. She was drinking pretty heavy when I let her have it. I hope she knows it was only a loan. There ain't no telling what I might have told her back at the time, but that old car was also my home. About 5 miles out, I was getting kind of tired, sweating hard and feeling kind of weak. I woke up with no cigarettes or nothing to drink, and I hadn't had a bite to eat. My nerves were so quick I couldn't tell where I was shaking. Then a set of brakes sang my song. Some fella stuck his head out of 57 Chevy and hollered, "Hey man, come on." I told him I was headed down to Chattanooga. They said, "Hop in, we're going there too." And the way they took off in a cloud of smoke, I still ain't believing it was true. They had the windows down and I was sitting in the back with my tongue still hung in my throat. He was hitting just about 110 and he said, "Man, what do you think of this boat?" Well, there was two semis struggling up ahead, one trying to pass the other. They had the whole road blocked, so he passed them on the right. And let me tell you something, brother, I was so nervous that my teeth was clicking. There wasn't no way my head could think. Then the one that was sitting on the passenger side turned and said, "Hey man, you want something to drink?" I just shook my head cause I couldn't talk. He said, "Okay," and then he said, "Cheers." Them fools was drinking whiskey and wine and chasing it down with beer. Well, I started sweating that old sticky sweat and I know I was white as a sheet. Then one turned the radio on wide open and said, "Hey man, check that beat." By the time we reached the top of Mont Eagle, I thought I heard a rumbling sound. And then I saw a sign that said Fallen Rock, and right there I was floorboard bound. I was rolling and squirming on the old floorboard, too weak to set or stand. And then the driver said, "We're doing 120. Look here, man, no hands." I got up enough nerve to raise up and look, and by now there couldn't be no surprise. But his hair was blowing all over my face and dandruff blowed in both eyes. He never did drive on the right or left. He just kept on riding that line. I rubbed my eyes and saw the prettiest thing, the Chattanooga City Limits sign. He slowed down and I said, "Mister, please, I'd like to get off right here." He said, "All right, on into town with us. We're gonna go down and pick up some more beer." I said, "Please," once more, and he stopped the car and then he handed me my sack. Said they'd look for me on the road later on in case I wanted to catch a ride back. I got out and sat down by the side of the road feeling sick and looking mighty pale. I don't remember anything much after that, but next morning I woke up in jail. I didn't know anybody in my cell and didn't want to ask why I was there. But they all kept grinning and turning their heads and it was more than my head could bear. So I called the jailer and asked him to tell me why I was there if he'd be so kind. He said, "For stopping the traffic while I was hugging and kissing the Chattanooga City Limits sign."
You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCRLP, 92.9 FM, Los Gatos and beyond.